Checking on the Arts is made possible by the Pink Palace Museum. Many of you know the work of Robert Gordon. His very well-known books included Came from Memphis, Can't Be Satisfied, The Life and Times of Muddy Waters, and Respect Yourself, Stax Records and the Soul Explosion, which we talked about not too long ago. He also won a Grammy for his liner notes to the Big Star box set, Keep an Eye on the Sky. Here lately, you might have heard about this amazing film, Best of Enemies, about William F. Buckley Jr. and Gore Vidal and their debates. It was shortlisted for an Oscar and won an Emmy. His new book, just out this week, as a matter of fact, is Memphis Rent Party. He's going to be signing it at the Stax Museum of American Soul Music tomorrow evening at 6:30, and then Friday evening, very appropriately.
Saturday evening,
at Ernestine and Hazel's. This is a really interesting book. I was reading through it, and I was trying to think of what it reminded me of, and I hope you appreciate this, is it sort of reminded me of Volume 1 of the Gonzo Papers by Hunter S. Thompson.
I'll take that.
Because it is sort of a look back at his early magazine work before he became, you know, King Gonzo. And that's what a lot of this is. It's a lot of your earlier magazine articles that we may not have seen before. It is some unpublished things.
Yep.
It is some interview transcripts that then led to other articles. And I'm fascinated about why you did this. Why did you? your other books, which of course I've read, are pretty much mainstream reportage, as it were. But this is a much more personal book, it seems like to me. Tell us about this.
Well, I'm very interested to hear your comparison there. Before I was ever a writer, when I was in college, and I was learning about the Harlem Renaissance, they talked about rent parties, that people would have a party in their house in order and charge at the door and sell food and booze, and that was how, and then if it was a success, they could make their rent that month. It occurred to me then in my dreams of wanting to be a writer that, wow, if I ever got to make a collection of short pieces, it'd be so easy. You just take these pieces, you throw them together. It's a rent party. Well, you know, so that idea hung with me. And then, of course, this is not that, because I wound up digging through a lot of older pieces. I wrote some new stuff. I wrote like half of this is unpublished and new material,
right,
you know.
Yeah. And
I just couldn't take the easy way out. I thought as I connected the individual profiles, my own immersion into meeting these people became connective tissue, and also as I was getting the bigger picture of Memphis and its impact and its range of art, that I could share those sort of realizations as I was getting them in the text. And it just turned into a really kind of personal story.
Yeah.
Of, I'm kind of in it, but I'm not in it. I'm in the intros, but I'm not really in the pieces.
Right. Yeah, which is really, you're in the intro and the outro, both of which I think are very important. And the story that you tell beginning the book in the introduction is when you saw Furry Lewis, when he opened up inadvertently, as it were, for the Rolling Stones in 1975. And I was there too. And that was sort of the seminal event that sort of started you on this voyage.
It was the lightning strike, you know, the adolescent lightning strike, 14 years old, standing on that field.
I've been worried all day, worried all night long. I've been worried all night long. I've been all day pleading, won't you please, Pally, come home.
Hearing Furry was, I think I knew about the blues then, but I didn't know that the blues guys were alive in Memphis.
Yeah.
That's what Furry told me. And then not too long after that, he showed up at my high school, MUS, and for a lunchtime performance, and I was going, wait a minute. The opening act for the Rolling Stones was at my high school, you know? And then I went to his apartment, and it sort of, and that's kind of the same way that He came from Memphis Begins, and that was interesting to me to go, because it's now, you know, it's kind of 30 years have passed,
right?
And to say, let me start from the same place but go somewhere else, and that was really interesting to pursue.
Yeah, it's and that was the first time that I had ever heard of Fergie Lewis also, and I was sort of, whoa, what is this?
Yeah.
And that sort of started my interest in this also. And then you sort of took that interest and started making these pieces around.
Yeah, it's amazing, you know, when I was hearing you give the description to me in the beginning, because after all this time of doing this, it's been like 30 years of freelancing or more of freelancing. And, you know, it's a grind. It's tough. You're as much for the work is finding the gigs. More of the work is finding the gigs than it is doing the writing. So the thing you love ends up becoming kind of second place, and first place is finding a way to do the thing that you love. And I remember talking to Jim Dickinson, a mentor of mine here from here in Memphis, great musician and philosopher, if we will.
Yeah, certainly.
And he talked about experiencing bitterness as he got older, and that he had Charlie Feathers as a guide, that Charlie had sort of let bitterness consume him, and Jim had witnessed that and didn't want that to happen. So I had that warning, and it was funny because, you know, after you spend so much time not doing what you want to do in order to do what you want to do, you get a little bitter. And doing this book was a way to address how to overcome that, kind of how to say, hey, this is, you know, I've it's been hard, but it's been incredibly rewarding.
You know, that's a really good point that you make. That in the afterword of this, that most of the people that you talk to in here are no longer with us,
right?
And this is sort of a really interesting way to sort of look back at these folks and not only how they've affected music, but how they affected you too.
How they affected me, and also when you start putting them together, you get this picture of Memphis. And that's what I really liked. And to me, it was it's always been, there's this spirit of Memphis, right? Like, but what is it? And to me, what it is it's Sam Phillips' mind, the guy who started Sun Records, who opened the door to Rufus Thomas and Howlin' Wolf and B.B. King and Phineas Newborn Jr. and Johnny Cash and Elvis Presley and, you know, on and on and on. That kind of open mind and that seeking of spirit, and so that to me kind of epitomizes Memphis. And I think that when he was seeking that spirit in these guys, what he was really seeking was a sense of individuality, and that became kind of my guiding mantra. Is like, and it's also why I think I'm not interested in the popular, you know, popular culture and popular items, because like what I got from Sam was he didn't want to find a person who could be a hit because anybody could sound like them. He wanted the person who no one could sound like.
Right.
He wanted the person that hadn't been heard before, something new. And that to me is the guiding spirit in this book, Rent Party.
We should mention that you actually open with Sam Phillips, and you do sort of an explication and analysis of his appearance on David Letterman, which I saw when it happened at the time. And like most people, I thought, is he drunk or is he just messing with these guys?
Yes, exactly.
And I should mention that when you talk about it in the book, you're viewing a fourth or fifth generation VHS tape.
Yeah.
That's what we had then.
Back in the day, yeah.
But this morning, actually, I got online, and you can find that as of this morning on YouTube.
Yeah.
So I encourage our listeners to go check that out and then read your analysis of it in the book.
It's an astonishing moment, and because as you watch it, Sam does appear to be drunk. He may or may not have been drunk, but as you watch it, you realize Sam's that's not the question here. The question is, what is Sam do? How is Sam producing David Letterman?
Exactly.
How did the guests get on the program and take charge?
Yeah.
And that is the mastery of a great producer. And we see that in that appearance with Sam on David Letterman.
And that's that theme sort of runs through the book in many ways, especially with Jim Dickinson, whom appears in here many times, about how do you get the performance that you want or the performance that these people are capable of giving.
Right. Jim was influential in shaping my perceptions of how music is made and how it has effect. And I know Sam-shaped gyms, and it comes down to psychology a lot of the times. In the recording studio, you know, it's sort of like, how do you deflect the pressure of being in there to create something great so that you can create something great? Because if you feel that pressure, it's just never going to happen.
Yeah.
And Jim was great at that. Jim was a storyteller, and he would, you know, leave you not realizing. He would leave you free to be the... To push yourself to be something new and different.
The cast of characters in this book is amazing.
Memphis, hear me.
Yeah, this is it. This is it right here. And there are people that you would expect, perhaps. Jeff Buckley, Otha Turner, Jerry McGill. what a character. And then some people that you might not expect. Especially, I was fascinated by your two chapters, one on Lead Belly and one on Robert Johnson.
Uh-huh.
And the Robert Johnson, I think every musician should be required to read that to get a sense of just what sort of business you're getting into.
It's a nefarious proposition entering the music business and seeing what can happen with your creations, how you, in innocence, can lose half your money on the first day that you are on the job.
Yeah.
You sign away your rights and you don't even know it. And that is what that piece explores. And again, you know, that's got a lot of great material from Dickinson, from Randall Lyon, from a lot of Memphis characters.
A lot of this has to do with a very much of a sense of place.
Mm-hmm.
Especially the things like Junior Kimbrough's
party. One of my favorite pieces.
Which is the rent party. It's the party in the book.
And
it just really gives you a sense of being there in a place and time that most of us will never experience.
That was Junior's place, his third to last place. Lots of people got to go to the last place. By the time he got to Chulahoma, word of that gig was getting known, and you could go out there and go into this little place and hear old hypnotic blues with people. You know, it's shamanistic in a way, with people throwing themselves into the spirit of the moment. But then before that, this was actually in his house in a cotton field. I mean, I remember so much about this because it was so powerful. We just kind of stumbled into it coming out of a record store in Holly Springs. People let us in a truck. They said, no, you can't find it, you know. And so they let us in a truck. They slowed. They pointed over the cab, you know, the driveway's here. And they had to do that because the break in the trees was so small.
Yeah.
You wouldn't notice it. And you went through this dense woods and it opened into this big field. And there's this, I mean, it wasn't quite a tar paper shack, but it was ramshackle in the middle of this cotton field, and Junior was kicking it. And there's actually a recording. There's a sound. I made a soundtrack for this book that Fat Possum Records has released.
Right.
And one of the times I went to Junior's house, I brought my little cassette recorder and stuck it in there and got a recording that you'll hear on here. And it kind of captures the feel.
That's one of the points that you make, is that we tend to think of the blues as being sort of a monolithic thing, as you know what the blues is.
Right.
And one of the good points that comes through all of this book, really, is it's not one thing. It's a lot of different things. And Otha Turner and the music that he makes, the fife and drum, is a very different thing from the Delta country blues.
Yes. And very different from the nearby hill country blues.
Exactly.
It's peculiar, really, in the whole nation. It used to exist in a county in Georgia and two counties right down there south of us in Mississippi, and now I don't even think it's existing in Georgia. And the great thing is that Otha's granddaughter, and there's photos of her in the book,
yeah,
at 6 years old holding this fife. I mean, I would see her. I saw her grow. I would go to those picnics. I saw her grow up every year playing, standing firm-footed on the ground, holding that fife and blowing. And I mean, you know, it's really cool when Otha would play, because he's this just intense, powerful man. But when his six-year-old granddaughter would do it, it evoked this whole jubilation. Everyone felt her, you know, the nascent power in her. And then there's another track on the LP of her jamming with Luther Dickinson, Jim's son, on an Otha track. And I was really taken by the influence. To me, that was the great, you know, I got great hope one day when I went to Kenny Brown's summer picnic in the hill country. Mm-hmm. I'm walking toward the field and it's hot. And I'm like, man, I could be home on my sofa, lying down, reading a book. What am I doing here? And Sade started playing. I was like, oh, yeah, you know, it's the old fife and drum stuff. I've heard it a million times. And then I heard her playing differently. And I realized, oh, my gosh, she has been influenced by Luther Dickinson. She played that fife with kind of a slide guitar feel,
yeah,
and it added a whole new excitement to me, and it reminded me how art is passed down and how it evolves with time, and that while she learned from Othar, she's doing her own thing.
Yeah. And that's a really good point, and that's something you bring up in the afterword, that although, as we said, many of these people are no longer with us, their influences are still here.
Absolutely.
Jim Dickinson's son, Luther and Cody, North Mississippi All-Stars, of course, and their ancillary projects going along with that, Charlie
yep.
Turner, and some of these other folks, they may be gone, but what is it Jim Dickinson's
I'm just dead, I'm not gone.
I'm not gone, exactly. Yeah. And that's the feel that you get from a lot of this.
Oh, good. Good. Yeah, it's good to hear your reactions. You know, this is kind of my first interview for the book, and so you know, I've read it, my wife's read it, some friends have read it, but I haven't gotten like a more outside. I'm really glad to hear what you're saying, Darryl. Thank you.
We're talking with Robert Gordon. His new book, Memphis Rent Party, is just now out. He's going to be signing it tomorrow evening at 6:30 at the Stax Museum of American Soul Music, and then Saturday evening at 8 at Ernestine and Hazel's, which is probably an extremely appropriate place for that.
And I've got a band of Memphis All-Stars who are going to be playing at Ernestine Hazel's. The gig is free.
Oh, great.
It features, it's kind of like the Mudboy and the Neutrons backing band steps to the fore.
Right.
Almost everybody in the band played with Mudboy at some time or another.
Okay.
Jim and Jill Lancaster, Joe Gasson, Jimmy Sigerson, a few others, and they're going to be, and I'm going to be doing a reading and signing. There'll be books for sale at both events, LPs at both events, and I'll be reading and signing. But that night, and we've got a DJ spinning soul hits at Stax on Friday night and a band at Ernestine Hazel's.
That is certainly appropriate, and I'm glad you're doing that. I'm glad you brought up Mudboy and the Neutrons, because that's another sort of seminal moment for you and a sort of thread that goes through the book also. And for our friends who don't know who these guys are, Lee Baker and Sid Selvidge and Jim Dickinson, of course, and
Jimmy Crosswaite,
who was just here a couple of months ago. that band is sort of a genesis of what would, I guess, be sort of the fusion of the blues and rock and roll into then spread out over this whole Memphis scene.
I've always described Mudboy and the Neutrons as what the Rolling Stones would like to have sound like if they had learned not from the records of the blues guys, but hanging around with the blues guys.
Exactly.
And initially, I was very frustrated that, like, why are the Rolling Stones so popular and Mudboy and the Neutrons are not so popular? And early on, talking to them, they were like, well, you know, we don't really want to be popular. You know, they always took the first gig, the first slot on a bill. You know, they wanted to be, it wasn't so much that they wanted to be more a legend than a band, but they wanted to be able to continue to make their music their way, and they didn't want the influence of outside success to make them start changing toward pop considerations.
One of the things that comes through in this book is the personal relationship that you had with many of these people. Jim Dickinson, certainly. Also people like Jeff Buckley.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something we haven't seen from you. That's something that I think that's valuable. I think that's it gives it certainly a personal feel to me.
Uh-huh. There's a funny thing about being a writer, because 99% of what I do is at home alone in the dark, basically.
Exactly.
My wife says, why don't you turn on a light? and then you have to go out and do this, and then you send the work out and it's public, and then I have to go do this public thing. But it's really a private endeavor more than anything. And And I like that privacy, and I've tried to protect it. I think it has to do with aging a little bit, and it was an opportunity too. You know, I saw that this could be, if I just had thrown the stories out there, you mentioned the Hunter Thompson influence. To me, when I was trying to figure this out, I was looking at older collections I had around the house of things, and the one that first clicked was Norman Mailer's advertisements for myself.
Oh, yeah.
Where he sets up every piece he does, and he's very personal about it. And I thought, okay, that's kind of what I want to do here. I'm going to open up a little bit. I want to give, in my intros, I can give context so that you don't have to know who the person I'm writing about is. If I share my interest in that kind of personal way in the beginning, it seeps into your understanding of the piece. And yeah, it was just an opportunity, and I seized it.
Robert, we could easily talk about every single person in this book, but I want to encourage people to get the book and read it. Very strange stories about Jerry McGill. Extremely strange story of James Carr.
Yeah.
And so get the
book. So that's interesting, just to make a last point. Some of the stuff was not only previously unpublished, it was unpublishable. Like, I couldn't have published that James Carr coda if he were alive.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And there's a piece on the newborn family, Mama Rose, Phineas, right, Calvin, which was unpublishable only because no one would have had interest.
Exactly.
This was an opportunity. It was like, oh, great, I've had this piece in my drawer for like 20 years, and now I can get it out.
Check out the book. So many great things in here. Jerry Lee Lewis, a look into the working of The Last Man Standing. Towns Van Zandt. What a great piece that was.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of Towns Van Zandt, and that was just marvelous.
I love the line in there that I went to the funeral, and Guy Clark puts on his guitar and he goes, well, I guess I booked this gig about 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And that really kind of captured. That was my experience with Towns, too. You were going to have a lot of fun, but you knew that he was on a downward spiral and having fun, doing what he wanted to do, but there was a death wish in there.
Yeah, yeah. Before you go, I'd like to ask if you'd read a little bit. This is from the introduction, and I think it sort of encapsulates a lot of what this book is about.
Okay. It's the last paragraph of the intro is at your choosing.
Yeah, yeah,
interesting
yeah.
to me. I'm thrilled. Okay. Memphis can be slacker city, all ideas and no action, or worse, all the wrong action. But if you listen to the past here, it propels you forward. There's truth in the spirit of our blues, rock and roll, and soul. And that's why they have each transcended their time. Each explosion remains vibrant and influential. Each was triggered by a defiance of society's norms, by benightedness and hubris, a striving for something new and different. Memphis is not for the moment, it's for the horizon. I learned from the generosity of Furry Lewis and Odessa Redmond, from artists and musicians, black and white, all living in the face of ignorance, sloth, and hate, what great art is possible in the shadows.
From the introduction to Memphis Rent Party, the new book by Robert Gordon. Listen, folks, if you care at all about the music of this area, you simply must have this book. It is just out. He's going to be signing it tomorrow evening at 6:30 at the Stax Museum of American Soul Music, Saturday evening at 8 at Ernestine and Hazel's. Music will be there both times, and you'll get to get a copy of this important Memphis music book. Robert, it's always a treat to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks, Daryl. Thanks for y'all doing this. Checking on the arts program every morning and some afternoons. Y'all are a great service to the city. Thank you.
Checking on the Arts is made possible by contributing listeners and by the Memphis Pink Palace Museum, inspiring visitors to discover engineering marvels and the new 3D movie Dream Big at the Pink Palace Giant Theater. Dream Big reveals the drive that motivates engineers to push the limits of innovation, all at the Pink Palace Museum.